Sri Lankan Kiwi Himali McInnes was a GP for a decade in South Auckland, based in Mangere, a community she cares deeply about. She now works at Three Kings. Over the years, she's seen firsthand how the human spirit can shine through hardship, through trauma and illness. Dr. McInnes has spoken to other medics about the patients whose situations have stuck with them. These stories are captured in her book, The Unexpected Patient, True Kiwi Stories of Life, Death and Unforgettable Clinical Cases. Tēnā koe, Himali.
Kia ora, Lynn, how are you?
I'm very well. Why did you write The Unexpected Patient? I mean, it was a lot of work and effort on your part and a lot of trust when you went out to talk to other medics about this. But what was the starting point?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've always found medicine to be a really fascinating field. Obviously, it's full of science and full of really interesting facts and figures and, you know, how the human body reacts to disease and to life events. But medicine is also really fascinating because it's full of stories. And I think that's one of the things that really draws me back to it again and again. And those are the stories that we remember, the stories of, you know, patients who've overcome insurmountable odds and flourished. Despite this. And I guess I wanted to capture a little bit of this in my book. And I wanted it to be particularly New Zealand centric and span lots of specialties and decades, actually, because the oldest story in there is from the 1980s right up till the present time.
I really like the title, The Unexpected Patient. Are many patients unexpected or surprising?
Not always immediately. Some are. Some of the stories in the book capture moments when people unexpectedly affected their medical practitioners and quite profoundly. Other stories became unexpected with time, with the passage of time, with the onset of new information and so on. For many of my colleagues, I would say that many patients change them incrementally rather than profoundly and suddenly. But certainly the stories in the book are those particular patients who have been very very unexpected and changed us in lots of ways. So it's not just, medics who change their patients, but it's vice versa as well.
When you went to your contributors, asking them to think about contributing to the book, did you give them a brief or a theme?
Just basically, do you have a story of a patient that has profoundly impacted you and why, was the basic premise.
And did everybody want to come on board? I imagine everybody had such patients in their lives, but did everyone say, yep, sign me up?
No, actually quite a few people said, no, sorry, I don't. as I just mentioned, a lot of people said some patients have affected me in little ways here and there, and I've changed through that process. So finding those particular stories where, you know, there's been one particular patient that has really impacted people is not that common, but it's out there. And those are the stories that I've included in this book.
Well, let's start with Jenny, because she will be well known, former ICU nurse, I understand, Boris Johnson's Kiwi COVID nurse. Uh-huh. When you went to, I mean, this is a surprising story. It's not Boris, who has been one of her memorable patients at all. A very different and really moving story.
That's right. Well, she had to sign a non-disclosure agreement about Boris, which is fair enough. And this is a very surprising story because, yeah, and I think it's interesting because it's one of those things that happened to people unexpectedly. I mean, this patient, Mario, ended up in ICU after an unexpected event. And he changed Jenny's perception of what unconsciousness entails. I mean, she's an extremely good nurse, and I really enjoyed talking with her. She's one of those really empathetic, warm, capable, practical people. And after our interview, I thought, wow, I'd love to be your friend, you know? So I'm sure she was an excellent nurse anyway. But after meeting this patient, she thought, she started to think, how much do people who are unconscious, how much can they hear? How much are they aware of? What is that definition? What is the delineation between life and death? And so that's really profoundly affected the way that she practices her craft going forward.
Can you describe, now Mario is not his real name, but it's very much a real story. So a patient who presented comatose, trying to find some way, or seen as some way, as communicating with his family who were grieving.
Correct, yeah. And we'll never know the full extent of obviously what he understood or was aware of. And to some extent, there is the patient's family also impact on this, because you know, it is their perceptions of what Mario was trying to tell them, about the messages that he was trying to give them. Now, in my medical frame of mind, I can think of a medical explanation for his behavior, but there is still that element of uncertainty.
It was a huge relief, though, this sign as they took it, the family took it, who were agonizing over whether or not to end his life effectively. And, I mean, it was a very, very moving story. It was a simple thing that happened, but it made all the difference.
Correct, that's right. And I think it's just being aware of what the family needs and what the patient wants, and, you know, incorporating that into the package of care that we give them is really important. And I think that's what Jenny and her team managed to do at that time.
I think another good example of what we're talking about is a tiny charge, a premature baby in Wellington.
Yes, and he's a really interesting little chap. Now, again, obviously he's only 11, and so I talked to his amazing mother, who's a very capable woman, Justine, and this family is based in Wellington, and he was a little prem baby that was born very early, at 24 weeks, when, you know, people aren't really supposed to be out in the world at that point in time. And there's often a lot of significant sequelae that can come from being born so early. And he was unusual in that at that time, which was 11 years ago, he went home with a lot of paraphernalia, like oxygen, tubing, all sorts of things. And I think, as you discovered through the story, at the time, the staff were very much focused on the medical aspects of his care. You know, how do you look after people when they're in NICU, which is the neonatal intensive care unit? How do you look after their physical needs? And they weren't really, they didn't have the time, basically, because they were so busy, to focus on the family's psychosocial needs. Harlow changed that because of the difficulties his family had looking after him when he went home. He's actually changed the way that the Wellington neonatal unit approach their patients. And it's also changed practice across the country. So he's quite a mover and shaker for somebody so little.
Now, some of these contributors have had their names changed. As I mentioned, some of the patients' names have changed. So have you worked very closely, particularly with patients, I guess, whose cases are mentioned, to make sure they're okay with it?
Definitely. So basically, where we could, we actually interviewed the patient themselves, because I was interested in the sort of the different narrative that they might have about their encounter with their health professional. A couple of people were happy to have their real names used, but for the most part, people wanted to be anonymous, and that's fair enough. I think that's partly part of our Kiwi psyche, you know. I think maybe if this was an Australian or American book, maybe people would be less likely to be anonymous. I don't know, but yeah, we worked very closely with them. We sent them the draft for them to read and to approve before we published the stories.
Ahmed, I think, is an example. This is how he adapted to trauma, having survived the Christchurch mosque terrorist attacks. How did he do it, and what was learnt from that?
He was a really interesting person. Now, I don't know his last name because, you know, he wanted to keep that private, but Ahmed is his real first name. And with his story, I just wanted to, I was thinking about the fact that when something traumatic happens, the rest of us in the community are appalled or horrified, or, you know, we have a range of emotions, right? And then the shock of it wears off for us. But for the people involved, it carries on. And I wanted to just delve into that. And the really fascinating thing about Ahmed is that he is just such a resilient person. It's not to say that the trauma doesn't still affect him in multiple ways every day, because it does. And he's obviously got a profound injury, and it's really life-changing. And the interesting thing for his rehab specialist was that he had such a high level of acceptance and resilience and hope. And I think his faith gives him that. his community gives him that, and he has inherent personal characteristics that also give him that. So it was really interesting, and you know, that it doesn't come out of nowhere, obviously. Yeah, I'd love to meet him one day.
Now, Himali, you, of course, had to choose one of your own patients to write about for yes. the book. And now this is an interesting choice, I thought.
Yeah, so this person I've known for a long time. Obviously, I've anonymized them because they did find it hard to read about their own story. And, you know, there were a few tears, and I felt really sorry for that, for causing the tears. But afterwards, they were like, they wrote me a note saying, thank you, Doc, for listening to my story. It's helped me to realize some parts of myself that I wasn't aware of. And I guess I chose this story because it wasn't one of those encounters that impacted me straight away. It was more of a journey, you know, that over several years. And this is so typical of general practice, really. And I'm a general practitioner. Typical of general practice, that whole thing of walking alongside a patient for years and years, and then how I changed at the same time through their story and through what I was reading and learning. My own cognitive bias became apparent, and I didn't even know that I had it. And, you know, I'd hate to be thought of as being racist or prejudiced, but that's what I was. And that was not through a deliberate desire to be difficult, but through out of ignorance, basically.
Your family came to New Zealand, or you came to New Zealand when you were just 15 from Sri Lanka. That must have been culturally quite extraordinary for you as such a young person.
Well, actually, I left Sri Lanka when I was one, and then we lived in Malaysia for a bit, and then Papua New Guinea, and then we came here when I was 15. So we moved around a lot.
But oh, yes, citizen of the world already.
Was it, sorry?
You were a citizen of the world already.
Exactly, and definitely in Papua New Guinea, I had so many international, you know, friends, like 71 different nationalities in that school, which was just a fascinating school. So actually, yeah, it was a culture shock coming here because it was at the time, especially in the high school that I went to for the last 2 years of my schooling, it was very monocultural and kind of boring. I won't mention the school, sorry, but you know, it was just, yeah, and it was a culture shock. You know, obviously now this is, New Zealand is home, but I have this tension of still not fully feeling like a New Zealander because I'm partly Sri Lankan, but Sri Lanka is not home, you know, and I'm partly a Kiwi, but I'm not fully Kiwi, if that makes sense.
Oh, well, I hope that's able to change because your contribution to the country has been enormous, and this includes working in Mangere in South Auckland. So as a young GP, what led you to set up there or to go there?
It happened through basically as a GP registrar, you get placed in, you know, in different practices, and one of my placements was Mangere, and I just loved working there. There is so much bad press about South Auckland. If you don't know it well, what you read in the media might inform your views. You know, crime, poverty, abuse, blah, 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 alcohol, and all of those sorts of negative social aspects. When you actually work there, yes, those things are present. They're undeniably present, but they are not the defining aspect of South Auckland. And although I don't work in South Auckland anymore, I hold a great deal of fondness for South Auckland and her people. And I think for me, the defining aspects of South Auckland are kindness and gratitude. In the way that people, random people, you know, you're crossing the road and somebody will just randomly stop their car for you to let you cross, even though there's no pedestrian crossing. The way Pacific grandmas come and kiss you on the cheek and say, thank you very much, doctor, as they leave. The way people give you little gifts. You know, people are not well off, but they're kind. And that to me is such a powerful and precious thing.
You said previously that in 2016 you would consider yourself to have been apolitical, but you heard a politician say that it's a choice to live in your car, and that really made you mad.
Oh, yeah. I mean, okay, so back in my 20s, when I became eligible to vote, I often didn't vote, which is terrible because I didn't know who to vote for. I didn't felt it made a difference to my life. If I did vote, it would just kind of be like a tic-tac-toe. Oh, I'll tick that box. You know, it was as random as that. In 2016, and partly because of working in South Auckland, there was a deepening crisis of homelessness. And at the time, yes, politicians were saying things like, it is a choice to be homeless, or there is no housing crisis. It is a figment of people's imagination. And yet, here in front of me, I could put my stethoscope on the rib cages of people who were suffering with really bad respiratory illnesses because they were living in their cars. And these were ordinary people, families where the parents were sometimes working two or three jobs just to make ends meet, and they couldn't afford their rents anymore. And that's why they'd taken to living in their cars. So in 2016, in June, I don't know if you remember, but there was a Park Up for Homes, which was like an event staged to raise awareness of homelessness in the community. And I think about 1,000 cars and 2,000 people took part, and we all parked up in our cars in the Mangere shopping centre car park. It was a very cold night. It was June, so the temperature fell to 6 degrees overnight. I took my Hunterway along for company, my dog, and honestly, she's such a princess because she just groaned and moaned and sighed the whole night long because it was so cold. And in the morning when I woke up, I just felt so grubby and uncomfortable and tired. And I thought, this is what people are doing night after night after night. And how do children focus at school when they feel like this? How do people work when they feel like this? Yeah, so it just gave me a lot of empathy, and it just made me really passionate as well about the people who are forgotten by politicians.
Dr. Hamali McInnes, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much. Ngā mihi. And her book is called The Unexpected Patient, True Kiwi Stories of Life, Death and Unforgettable Clinical Cases. It's published by HarperCollins.